LEA, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claim, is now in session. The Honorable William P. Green, Jr., Chief Judge, presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Good afternoon. We're convened to hear the case of Donalyn V. Shinseki. Are counsel ready to proceed? Okay, Mr. Carpenter, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve
10
minutes.
10 minutes, all right. And for the government? All right. Mr. Carpenter, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Kenneth Carpenter, also appearing on behalf of Mr. Don Allen, is Glenda Hurl, non-attorney practitioner with Carpenter Chartered. I believe, Your Honors, the best place to start in this case is the Board of Veterans Appeals decision at page 2 of the record, which contains both a single finding of fact and a single conclusion of law. In that finding of fact and conclusion of law, the board makes a favorable finding of fact that there is a post-service disability from the disease which occurred while on active duty for training, and implicitly makes a determination that Mr. Don Allen had qualifying status as a veteran in his period of active duty for training. Necessarily, then, this court is bound by those two favorable findings of fact.
Is VA bound by that favorable finding of fact?
Yes, Your Honor.
In other words, VA could not come back later and find by clear and unmistakable error that Mr. Don Allen should not have received status?
They could review it for clear and unmistakable error, and if they determined that that was a clear and unmistakable error. And I believe, too, Your Honor, that this court's obligation to deal with findings of fact by not disturbing them would likewise be covered by this court's law jurisdiction if this court determined that as a matter of law he did not have the status. However, we believe that the board was correct in that determination and that Mr. Don Allen actually had qualifying status as a veteran because of his active duty for training, and that there was aggravation of a pre-existing disease or the presentation for the first time of a disease while on active duty for training.
I'd like to go back before you get too far afield. Let me
clear up one thing about the page 2 reference. Mm-hmm. You're talking about in the findings of fact?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there's a single finding of fact.
That it was not incurred during active duty for training?
Yes. And essentially, they combine two different findings. They make one finding that what they describe as the disability as a status post-colectomy with incisional hernia for rectal cancer was not incurred during active duty for training, and then they go on to say that it was not aggravated during that period of service.
So is your assertion limited to that there is a favorable finding that there is an increase in disability?
Actually, I don't believe that they make that finding in the findings of fact.
Okay, so what are you asserting?
I'm asserting that they make two favorable findings of fact. First, that Mr. Don Allen had the status of a veteran and that he had a disability resulting from the disease which was noted during his period of active duty for service.
Can you point to what in the decision makes you think that they found that he has a veteran status?
Nothing explicitly, Your Honor. And quite candidly, that's part of the problem with the findings of fact in this case, that the board did not make explicit findings of fact necessary to support their conclusion of law. However, this court is, I believe, bound by the implicit finding of fact that he had the status of veteran, or quite frankly, there was no point in dealing with the question of whether the condition was incurred during or aggravated during his period of active duty for training. It simply makes no logical sense.
Unless the board erred in, well, frankly, that what the status and how VA does that determination, I think, is one of the questions we want to talk about today. But assuming that they shouldn't have considered the presumption of aggravation and 1153 at this status, couldn't that simply have been an error instead of a baseline finding that leads to step two?
It is possible to interpret, well, that is certainly a way to consider what happened in this board decision. I do not believe that is an accurate way of addressing what happened in the entire adjudication of this matter. From the very point in time of his determination while in service of whether there was a line of duty incurrence, this has always been treated as an aggravation. And he has never been advised by the VA that they did not consider him to have status necessary to submit a claim.
So you're relying on not just the board decision for line finding of fact, but the entire
adjudication
process
of this matter from the first time, as I understand the law, the VA should have, if they had a question of his status, they should have notified him of that at the time of his application, and that the initial application should have been denied on the basis of his lack of status.
Isn't that what the regional office did? Didn't the regional office say that he did not have status?
And he appealed that decision and got a de novo decision
so
by the board.
Is it equally as implicit that since the board found that there was no aggravation, you with me?
Mm-hmm.
That he implicitly does not have veteran status?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because that defeats the purpose of one review of the Secretary's decision. The Secretary made a status determination in the first instance that there was no status, and clearly...
But why did they determine he had no status?
Why did who?
The regional office.
The regional office, as I recall, on the basis of his active duty for training status.
But in order to achieve status as an active duty trainee, mm-hmm. you have to have an injury or disease contracted in line of duty while in training.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that
so
the evidence
if you don't have an aggravation of a disease, pre-existing disease, during training, you wouldn't be able to qualify for status.
If there was no disease or injury shown to have been incurred in or aggravated during service, then the basis for the denial would be that, as opposed to his status as a veteran.
Tell me what a National Guard active duty trainee needs to achieve status.
He has to have, as happened in this case, the incurrence of a disease which was either directly incurred, meaning it had no precedent, or it was aggravated due to a pre-existing condition.
Right.
And I will tell you quite candidly that the evidence in this case is not remotely clear about whether there is or isn't a relationship between what happened to this man in service with the perforation of his small bowel and discus and his cancer.
So do you abandon your briefed prayer for relief of reversal and instead rely on remand to further develop the record?
No, I believe that reversal is required based upon the finding of fact that was made in this case. The finding of fact that was made in this case was that there was an existing disability and it was not aggravated. The only issue of law that has been presented in this case is whether or not the VA met its evidentiary burden to support its determination that this condition was not aggravated. They made the determination that there was a condition that preexisted and that condition was not aggravated based upon their finding that there was clear and unmistakable evidence which showed that it was not aggravated during active duty for training. That's the issue that was decided by the board, and that's the issue that should be reviewed by this court to determine whether they were legally correct that the VA had or had not met its burden. We believe that the evidence does show an increase based upon the determination that there is a relationship between the two, and that consequently, once the increase has been shown, i.e. his surgery, that the VA's burden is to show by clear and unmistakable evidence that the condition was not aggravated. There is simply no evidence in this record to support that. The only evidence that even attempts to address it is at page 580, and it's actually repeated at 581 of the record, a December 7, 2006 opinion, which is a single paragraph long, which simply doesn't answer the relevant question. The relevant question is, what is the basis for an opinion that the condition was not aggravated or was the natural progression of the pre-existing colon cancer condition?
What about the statement that Dr. Cunahan made in his August 98 letter to Whom It May Concern, where he says the leak was from radiation changes in the small bowel?
And that's why I suggest, Your Honor, that the evidence in this case is muddled to the extent that I'm not sure whether he's saying that's an independent leakage or that is a leakage that was produced by the pre-existing colon cancer. But he clearly states that there was nothing reasonably foreseeable that one could have expected this to happen. Therefore, if it was not reasonably foreseeable, it could not have been the natural progression of the pre-existing colon condition. And that's the critical evidence that's absent from this record. There is no evidence that ties the bowel and viscous perforation to the natural progression of the pre-existing colon cancer. And in order to meet their evidentiary burden under 1153, they have to show by clear and unmistakable evidence that there was not an aggravation because it was the natural progression. The only medical opinion that they have that addresses this, the board conceded when they requested the second opinion that the first opinion obtained on remand was not sufficient and not adequate to address their concerns and address the necessary evidentiary burden that has to be met by the VA. That's the ultimate issue in this case. The board determined that the criteria for service connection for what they described as the disability had not been met. And their findings of fact predicated that on two alternative bases. One, that it wasn't incurred, and second, that it was not aggravated during the period of active duty for training.
I'd like to turn a little bit to the question that we presented for supplemental briefing about the standard that should be applied in assessing the veteran status piece of this. Could you discuss that?
Well, it seems to me, Your Honor, that this court's case law is a bit confusing on that issue because of the early case of Biggins and a follow-up case in Paulson. And I'd like to discuss Biggins first because it seems to me that it's important to understand Biggins in order to understand Paulson. In Biggins, this court held that the presumptions that exist under 38 U.S.C. 1112 and its implementing regulations were unique and did not apply to persons on active duty for training, because persons who are on active duty for training never have 90 days of active duty for service. And at least that was the implicit assumption. Now, obviously, if a person, for whatever reason, was able to show that they had 90 days of active duty for training, then possibly the 1112 presumption might, in fact, apply. But certainly in the facts that were presented in Biggins, the narrowness of the holding in Biggins is merely that the 1112 presumptions did not apply. There is no prerequisite for minimum days on active duty service under the definition of both veteran and of active duty for training, which is described as being on active duty for service, and therefore under the provisions of 1112, the appellant in this case meets the qualifications and status as a veteran. This court's decision in Paulson dealt with a psychiatric disability and dealt specifically with the presumption of soundness and found that the presumption of soundness did not apply, but in fact remanded the matter for consideration of the presumption of aggravation. And therefore, I do not believe that the holding in Paulson can be relied upon in this case to suggest that somehow this matter qualifies under the language in Paulson to disqualify Mr. Don Allen as a veteran.
It seems to me that in Paulson, the court found that the board didn't err in applying the presumption of aggravation in its decision, which possibly suggests an extension of Paulson to say that the presumption of soundness, or the presumption of aggravation, like the presumption of soundness, doesn't apply here.
Well, it's certainly possible to read Paulson that way. The problem that I have in reading Paulson that way is that the concluding paragraph of the Paulson decision, however, says that, nevertheless, on remand, if warranted in light of the findings on the issue as to whether the appellant's condition preexisted service, the board is also required to re-adjudicate in-service aggravation. So clearly, the court was vacating with instructions to address the question of pre-existing condition.
Right, but it doesn't say how to re-adjudicate the issue of aggravation. It could be the very process that we're contemplating here, which is what do you do if you're presented with evidence of an increase in disability? Do you then determine whether it was the natural progress of the disease? Does the burden shift, or do you determine by a preponderance of the evidence that it's the natural progress of the disease, and then the appellant then has the, who knows?
Well, I think that's a fair statement. Who knows? However, the board was instructed to re-adjudicate the issue of aggravation. The board in this case adjudicated the issue of aggravation. Now, I agree with you that this court's case law is not clear as to what the burden-shifting components are, with the exception of the fact that 1153 has been interpreted by the VA to require them to present clear and unmistakable evidence that the condition was not aggravated during service.
Well, and also by the Federal Circuit and this court, so in Wagner, for example.
Yes, but in Wagner, it was dealing, as it were, parenthetically with the notion of the presumption of soundness, which really does not come into play in this case, at least in terms of the argument that was presented by Mr. Don Allen in his brief to the court. His brief to the court limited the question to the second part of the fact finding, which deals only with the presumption of aggravation, because he believes he has a disability that is related to his pre-existing colon cancer that was aggravated during service. And clearly there is no evidence, let alone clear and unmistakable evidence, to rebut that presumption. The question, I think, becomes as a question of law for this court as to whether or not this really is a presumption or not. I recognize that the VA has interpreted by regulation as a presumption, but if you read 1153, 1153 does not use the term presumption. And in fact, based upon this court's case in Hunt, a presumption requires an affirmative showing. Aggravation requires an affirmative showing. A presumption removes the obligation or burden to show a particular fact. So under the holding in Hunt, interpreting 1153, you are required as the appellant to come forward and show that there was an increase beyond.
But then you are relieved of the obligation of showing that it was beyond the natural progress, or I mean, that it was a result of the natural progress.
That's correct. And the burden further shifts to the VA to come back with affirmative evidence that is clear and unmistakable. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
No, isn't that nothing more than a rebuttable presumption then?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because a presumption operates to remove the burden from the veteran to make a showing. Mm-hmm. The showing is in fact imposed based upon this court's interpretation of 1153 in Hunt that the veteran actually has to make a showing of increase. If he or she doesn't make the showing of increase, then there is no entitlement to the presumption.
Well, but for example, in Agent Orange, which is an unquestionable presumption, they have to make a showing that they served in Vietnam or were otherwise exposed to Agent Orange. So just because they have to show something doesn't make it per se not a presumption also, because they're still relieved of some portion of the burden of production.
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that the Agent Orange analogy does not work, because the Agent Orange analogy, like this case, goes back to the question of status. Do you meet the status under the presumptive requirements to have had boots on the ground? If you haven't had boots on the ground in Vietnam, then you're not entitled, with the exceptions that have now been carved out, to that presumption. So you have to establish the right, the status to that presumption.
Thank you. Yeah. Did the board address status in this case?
Not correctly, briefly, and not specifically to this veteran.
Did they have to if they found that there was no aggravation?
No. May it please the court, my name is Shanti Hageman, counsel for the secretary. With me at counsel's table is Brian Ripple. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'd like to make a couple rebuttal points. With respect to Your Honor's opening inquiry, the board implicitly found that that Mr. Donilon was not a veteran. And with the question of statutory construction in 101-24B, the court can review that de novo, which would not alter the outcome of the board's decision, and that's why counsel indicated that it wouldn't necessarily matter. The court has brought to light a critical issue briefly touched upon by the board, but overlooked in the party's initial briefs. Specifically, it is necessary to determine whether an individual like Mr. Donilon is a veteran qualified to receive VA benefits. This afternoon, the secretary will demonstrate that such an individual is not. As an initial matter, it appears that both parties agree that a claimant has the burden of proving veteran status and that VA has a related duty to assist. But the central issue and key disagreement between the parties, based on the supplemental briefs, is the meaning of aggravated in line of duty as set forth in 101-24B's active service requirement. Active service is required for an individual like Mr. Donilon to achieve veteran status, under 101-2. To determine active service, Congress set out purposeful distinctions among active duty for training and inactive duty for training that are clearly enumerated in 101-24A, B, and C. The distinctions impose additional requirements on the latter two categories for active service and then veteran status. So this afternoon, the Secretary will explain how statutory construction, case law, and congressional intent inform the meaning of aggravated in line of duty as set forth in 101-24B's active service requirement.
Where should we look, counsel, in the board decision to find where the board said that this is not a veteran? What informs us that the board was making that decision with regard to Mr. Donilon?
Your Honor, it would be the board's finding that there was no aggravation, the rejection of natural progress, even under the more onerous burden of clear and unmistakable evidence. It as I'll explain this morning, it's the secretary's position that a claimant has to present evidence of an increase in disability and a worsening beyond natural progress. So without those two things, implicitly, he would not be a veteran. And both parties agree that under principles of statutory construction, Section 1153 informs the meaning of aggravated in line of duty as used in 10124B. We diverge in that appellant contends that he only has to demonstrate the first part of 1153 addressing an increase in disability. The secretary contends that such an individual must present evidence that any worsening in disability extend beyond the natural progress. So the logical question is, why would a claimant such as Mr. Donilon have the burden of proving a worsening beyond natural progress when in an aggravation analysis the burden of finding natural progress typically lies with VA? Well, as I'll discuss further, the burden shifting aspect of 1153 does not apply until a claimant is a veteran. And this makes sense where the court in Jensen observed that placing the burden of finding natural progress on the government is consistent with the congressional intent to give veterans liberalized methods of proving service connection. Jensen pointed out that the burden of proving natural progress is logically with the government because the government is in the best position to have reliable medical records, including induction, separation, examinations. The flip side of this would be that the government does not typically have these examinations when someone's going in and out of active duty for training. Like in this case, the pertinent records are all private until VA undertook its own development. So the burden to prove a worsening beyond natural progress under the preponderance of the evidence standard is logically upon an active duty training claimant until veteran status is established.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument that because the appellant has this burden of production to come forward demonstrating an increase in disability in the first place, that it's not actually a presumption?
Well, as Your Honors pointed out, it is a rebuttable presumption made clear in its wording and this court's jurisprudence and that of the Federal Circuit. Your Honor, are you asking when a claimant comes forward or when a veteran comes forward?
I don't know that the counselor for the appellant is making a distinction between when a claimant comes forward or when a veteran comes forward. So I'd kind of like to see if you can either make or blur that distinction for me.
Using 1153 as a purely definitional device to inform what 10124B means for a claimant who is not a veteran, the secretary would submit that the first part of that is presumptive when we're dealing with veterans, but true aggravation encompasses natural progress. And so a claimant would have to prove true aggravation as opposed to presumed aggravation because that burden shifting aspect wouldn't apply until a claimant was a veteran.
I was going to say, let me just back up to what you were saying about the reasons why you don't think that the burden shifting aspect would apply in a claimant context as opposed to a veteran already conferred status context. You argue that it's based on congressional intent to ease the burden for people who have already established that they are veterans. However, in your briefing, you state that the duty to assist would still apply to helping this person demonstrate that they are a veteran. Isn't that also a way of easing the burden or helping somebody demonstrate or win their case that so how do you distinguish between this duty to assist and this duty to alleviate this burden? Why would Congress impose a duty on this population but not a similar duty on this population?
Because Congress set forth these purposeful distinctions that the courts recognized in Biggins and Paulson, and there are additional requirements for active duty training claimants. It's as Congress intended and the courts recognized in its case law. So we would have to have true aggravation, a preponderance showing the entire 1153 nutshell to lend meaning to those distinctions. Section 1153 was created for veterans long before benefits were extended to reservists, and the language of 1153 has changed very little since that time. Biggins and Paulson respectively highlight the statutory construction of 10124 and the congressional intent to distinguish active duty for training claimants from those who served on active duty. The logic in these cases indeed extends to an analysis of an individual with active duty for training who seeks service connection through aggravation. As appellants pointed out, the Biggins court engaged in statutory interpretation to find that the claimant was a veteran if she was disabled or died from a disease or injury incurred in or aggravated in the line of duty. As we know, the claimant in that case was not a veteran because there was not a documented disease or injury in service. Here, the determinative question is whether there is aggravation in service, as this is how Mr. Don Allen can establish the active service requirement for veteran status. And building on Biggins, the Paulson court found that a claimant with active duty for training must establish service connection in order to achieve veteran status to trigger the presumption of soundness. Paulson pointed out the clear distinction that Congress laid out between those who served on active duty and those who served on active duty for training. So having failed to establish service connection and therefore veteran status, the claimant in that case did not have the benefit of the presumption of soundness or the presumption of aggravation. This added requirement furthered the congressional intent to distinguish those who served on active duty from those who served on active duty for training.
So your position is that Paulson held that the presumption of aggravation doesn't apply to people who have not established veteran status yet?
It suggests that. I believe the last paragraph that
So it could be dicta or it could be a holding. What is your position?
More akin to dicta.
Thank you.
So back to this case. In this case, based on these intended distinctions set forth by Congress, Mr. Don Allen must establish each aggravation element, an increase in disability, and a worsening beyond natural progress. This conclusion would further the congressional intent to distinguish active duty for training claimants from those who served on active duty and those who served on inactive duty for training. To require that the claimant show merely an increase in disability would render the duty distinctions less meaningful with respect to an active duty for training claimant seeking service connection through aggravation. To address the view that Hunt informs the entire definition of aggravated in line of duty for determining active service, Hunt clearly deals with the first section of 1153 and sets forth what the initial increase in disability is. In reviewing 1153's precursor, the Hunt Court reviewed the board's holding with respect to the presumptive portion of 353, discussing what will be considered aggravated, quote, what will be considered aggravated when there is an increase in disability. The Secretary does not dispute that Hunt helps inform what a veteran must establish for an increase in disability. However, Hunt does not address the entire scope of aggravation to include natural progress, which is part of the 1153 framework. And an aggravation analysis always includes assessment of natural progress.
Are you saying, counsel, and I think you did say this, and I just want to make sure that I've got it right, that in the unique situation of somebody performing active duty for training, unlike the situation where we have a veteran who's on active duty, you first look at service connection in order to determine whether or not somebody is a veteran?
You look at that aggravation issue, whether there was a disability aggravated in line of duty. So that would come before. But in Paulson, service connection had to be satisfied before the active duty training claimant was a veteran. In this case, the pre-existing condition was not in dispute, so we're right in there with the aggravation analysis, and he would need to prove that he had a disability aggravated in line of duty. So it comes down to the definition of aggravated in line of duty.
So then would you say that where the board member referred in the last several paragraphs of the board decision to a claim for service connection having to be denied, and that the conditions don't warrant service connection, that that's tantamount to a finding that the person is not a veteran?
No, but it's analysis with respect to the clear and unmistakable evidence, and the factual record here and the factual conclusions that it draws is tantamount to finding a lack of aggravation, and an aggravation is necessary for active service, and active service is necessary to become a veteran under 101-2.
Then what would happen if you determined using this service connection first to determine that somebody is a veteran when they're on active duty for training? If you determine that they are a veteran for that purpose, then what do you do with regard to 1153 when you examine for service connection?
It's a bit circular, but as mentioned, 1153, in mostly its original form, preceded benefits to those on active duty for training. So it's circular, but it's circular because Congress intended it to be circular and set forth these distinctions. And so he establishes veteran status, and now we move to 1153. He is a veteran for service connection purposes and aggravation purposes. The burden would shift to the government to prove by clear and unmistakable evidence. He hasn't satisfied service connection totally by becoming a veteran.
But by establishing by a preponderance of the evidence, as you suggest, that it's beyond the natural progress of disease, it would be virtually impossible for the Secretary to rebut by clear and unmistakable evidence.
That's
would
true,
it not?
Yeah.
And
yes.
Doesn't that render 1153 a nullity under those circumstances?
It doesn't render 1153 a nullity with respect to veterans who it was intended to protect. And it's hard to get around these additional that Congress has required this additional aggravated in line of duty for an active duty for training individual to become a veteran.
Is determination of veteran status primarily a factual determination?
It normally is under the case law. It's a factual finding.
Let's assume that we don't accept your argument that we have determination of veteran status within this board decision. Is the court then informed by Nolan that it ought not to look behind a favorable decision with regard to a factual finding by the board, and in fact would be reversed if we did so? Now, in fairness, Nolan was not the same distinction here. Nolan was, as I recall, well-grounded. But it was a case in which this court looked behind the determination that a claim was well-grounded. The board determined that the claim was well-grounded, made a decision on the merits. This court then said the claim was not well-grounded.
Right.
And Nolan reversed at the Fed Circuit. Is that analogous to this situation?
I don't think so, because the outcome would not be different under those circumstances.
Explain that, please.
In this case, regardless of whether the board made a favorable finding or a favorable finding of fact that he was a veteran, the board proceeded that he was a veteran led to inured to a more favorable standard for the veteran, so any error would be harmless, and we don't have the well-grounded attendant problems with that any longer.
What if we found, as the appellant suggests, that the record is insufficient to demonstrate by clear and unmistakable evidence that the increase in disability was due to the natural progress of the disease?
Well, it's the Secretary's position that there is sufficient evidence to rebut the presumption of aggravation. So if you found that there was insufficient... So if we were to accept the implicit finding that he was a veteran...
Right.
And then...
then would we be compelled to reverse and award service connection?
Not. I think there's an opening for, and the court's order set this out, for the court to review this matter de novo. It is a legal issue, which would essentially, you know, render the board's analysis incorrect, and that, but again, harmless error.
Only if we agree with the ultimate
right.
conclusion. I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the record. Can you show me where in Dr. Ford, the IMO's statement, the issue of whether in-service worsening of the appellant's condition represents an increase beyond the natural progress of the condition is described?
As acknowledged in our brief, Dr. Ford did not specifically address natural progress, but she did say that it was not unexpected that a fistula would reopen. And the fistulas were...
But she also says that nothing in his, or that he returned to duty too early. So would that imply that service exacerbated his condition?
No, that in the Secretary's view, that would imply the opposite, that he was healing from a disease and that someone with this disease who resumed physical activity would, as part of the natural disease process, it would reopen, would have similar symptoms to that of appellant.
She also says that she doesn't think returning to training caused the return of his condition. So I'm a little confused.
I think that is didn't independently cause his condition, the complaint of condition. And then the, and if you look at this with coupled with the VA opinion, both of these opinions together seem to suggest that the overall condition was not unexpected, and with Dr. Cunahan's statements as well. But that Dr. Ford said it is not unexpected that he could have had a setback and the fistula could reopen.
Do we have evidence that the fistula was in the exact same location?
No. No. It's been through.
Thank you.
So, to recap, as we go around this mulberry bush, or whatever you want to call it, this circular logic or circumstance that Congress has created by the time you get around to determine if the veteran or if the claimant is a veteran for active duty for training purposes, if you conclude that the person is a veteran, then there's a win.
Usually, yes.
I mean, you've gone through the elements of service connection.
Yes.
In order to get veteran status. So that's, so if the appellant is saying that there was an implicit finding of status, then there's implicit finding of service connection.
Right, and that was, I think, what Judge was asking earlier.
And under Nolan, well, would we be bound to recognize that favorable finding if there was such a finding, to the exclusion of determining as a matter of law,
right,
then the individual would not be entitled to that benefit?
I think it turns on, you know, a de novo interpretation of 10124B, which the court has the power to.
And was it, is there any relevance to the two findings either by the service department as well as the as well as VA that these conditions experienced by Mr. Donnellan were not in line of duty?
No, the medical record, it's the Secretary's decision that the medical record is strong enough. I see. Whether those are adjudicative, probably not. Since subsequent to that time, there have been, I think the case has gone back up to the board and back down. And it would still be the Secretary's position that this is an, that the board implicitly made a favorable, or a finding of fact that this individual is not a veteran.
Anything? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. I can conclude quickly. Based on Congress's intent and the holdings in Biggins and Paulson, the Secretary urges the court to hold that a claimant like Mr. Donnellan must prove that a disability worsened beyond the natural progress to achieve veteran status, and similarly to affirm the board decision.
Mr. Carpenter?
May it please the court, I do not believe that there is any basis for the government's position in this case. There is no authority in any statute, in any congressional intent, for the position taken by the VA, as has been articulated. You have to start with the definitions that have been provided by Congress. Congress at 101, 38 U.S.C. 1012, defines the term veteran to mean a person who served on active military, naval, or air service. At 10124 capital B, it says that the definition of active military, naval, or air service is to include any period of active duty for training during which an individual concerned was disabled from a disease that was aggravated in the line of duty. This notion that we're going to turn this system on its head because there's now a difference, according to the VA, between active duty service members and active duty service members who are on active duty for training, simply has no support. This board's decision never informs this court, or more importantly, Mr. Donnellan, that he was not a veteran. As Judge Green has correctly observed, the regional office did that from the beginning. They said, you're not a veteran. The board didn't do that. Now the VA comes up and defends this case on the basis that for the first time in my awareness, we adjudicate service connection in order to defeat the claim of veteran status. But that, quite candidly, is absurd. You have to start with the element of status first. And even though this court's case law does not clearly articulate that, I think it is fair to read the status line of cases in this court's jurisprudence.
How does a National Guard individual, mm-hmm, who's normally under the state, They get called to active duty under federal authority, and it's for that period of time that they are protected under these benefits.
That's correct, when they are called up for active duty for training under federal jurisdiction.
And so, consequently, isn't the definition saying that for those people who are active duty for training under Title 32, whatever it is, they can get the benefits if they are injured or a condition is aggravated during that training and it was in line of duty?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So if it doesn't meet that, they don't qualify for active service.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that,
if they don't qualify for active service, they're not a veteran.
That's right. And that is a factual determination that should have been made by the board in this case. It implicitly made that decision because it adjudicated service connection. The VA comes up with its post hoc rationalization and says to the court.
How are you going to make a determination if there was an injury or aggravation during that active duty for training without making a determination as to service connection?
Because they're two separate things. There either was an incurrence,
all right,
or there wasn't. And in this case, there clearly was. There
so what was the evidence of incurrence?
That he was taken to surgery and had surgery on the perforation of his small intestines and his viscus.
And then I'll ask you the question, did the finding that that was not in line of duty have any bearing on the question?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
It is. Well,
so if it didn't, then they have to determine, knowing that it was pre-existing, whether or not there's any, is this an aggravation of the underlying condition?
Well, they actually have two jobs, Your Honor, because the statute provides for compensation for incurrence and compensation for aggravation. There is no distinction between that and incurrence and aggravation for any other active duty service.
But member. Hasn't this court in Paulson found a distinction when it comes to incurrence?
I believe not, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I do not believe you cannot reconcile that imagined holding in Paulson with the final paragraph.
Not with regard to aggravation, with regard to soundness.
I believe that Paulson merely applied the facts as they existed in Paulson. I do not believe that they established a rule in Paulson, and if they did, they mistakenly relied on Biggins to do so. And they cannot rely on Biggins to do so because Biggins only dealt with the presumptions under 1112. And any extrapolation that the presumption of soundness does not apply, I think is simply inconsistent with the definitions. Why would an active duty for training person who meets the qualifications for a disease or injury incurred while on active duty for training or the aggravation of a pre-existing condition be denied the benefit of the statutory presumptions that are available to any other veteran, with the exception of those veterans in which the presumption involves a post-service disability that developed under 1112 that requires 90 days of active duty service? And there is simply no justification for extending the holding in Paulson to exclude the right to the presumption of aggravation, and I do not believe that Paulson in fact stands for the proposition that the presumption of soundness is not available to persons who qualify for active duty for training entitlement to compensation. In regards to the question of Nolan, I do believe that Nolan is analogous because there is no distinction between active duty service when you are in active duty service with a regular call-up versus a temporary call-up for active duty for training. The board adjudicated service connection in this case. There can be no dispute over that. That's what they decided. They decided he was not entitled to service-connected compensation for the post-service disability that he had that arose during his period of active duty for service. Implicit in that is a determination that he was a veteran and that he had a disability.
I want you to go through your construct for me. Mm-hmm. Status is the first element that you prove.
Correct.
So you're the adjudicator, and you have an active duty trainee before you. So how do you prove status? How do you determine whether the evidence establishes status?
Well, notwithstanding the determination that was made in this case, I believe that when you are confronted with facts such as this, where an active duty service member is taken to a hospital and they perform surgery on him, there was a disease that was incurred. So I believe the definition has been met. It was during his period of active duty for training, and he had a medical intervention.
So then the only question then remains is, like under 1153, whether or not it is the natural progress of the disease.
That's correct. But it could also be whether this was, I mean, as has been suggested here, the medical evidence in this case is not abundantly clear as to whether or not the perforation was at the same location. And the government has conceded that it wasn't. Well, if it wasn't, does that mean that it's related to the colon cancer or not? No one has said dispositively one way or the other. The treating doctor said he was fine, he was fit for duty, he was able to do it. You can read the treating doctor's medical evidence to suggest that it was part of the same type of abscess that simply developed at a different location, which he said was not foreseeable. But if it was a disease that was incurred, and let's just assume that it was a heart attack, and he had no previous heart condition noted, he has that heart condition, is taken for coronary care at a local hospital while active duty for training, he's entitled to compensation for any resulting disability under 1110. To treat active duty for training veterans different from other veterans is simply inconsistent with the definition.
I appreciate your explanation, because I guess taking what you just said, the incurrence of a potential aggravation of a pre-existing disease. We know he has this colon problem when he starts active duty for training. We know that he's been put in the hospital while during the time of training.
Yes.
So that presents a prima facie case, if you will, of certainly incurrence. And then the question is that an increase in the severity of the pre-existing condition?
And therefore, he meets the status, and if he met the status, then the only question is, did the VA meet its evidentiary burden after there was a showing of an increase? There was a showing of an increase under Hunt because he had to have medical intervention. They said that it was rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence, and it is simply incomprehensible where they would have found evidence, let alone clear and unmistakable evidence, that this was the natural progression, when natural progression isn't used in the IMO. I see that I'm beyond my time. Unless there's any further questions.
You.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Case is submitted. We will greet counsel, and then the court will adjourn.
All rise.